Blog Talk Radio. I'm Lauren Leibowitz, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio and How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes. You've been listening to music by Keith Chagall entitled Diamonds of Hope. It's beautiful. I love that's a nice little way to start our show today. It's Thursday, April 15th, and once again, we are coming to you live from Los Angeles, as I do every Thursday at 3 p.m. Pacific time, and it's also tax day, and I know most of you, I think I saw most of you today in the post office standing in line mailing your tax papers. So now at the end of the day, it's time to indulge in a little time for you, and we love hearing from you. So join us to listen in or ask questions by dialing 347-857-2710. We are here live until 3:45 p.m. Pacific time, and let me give you those 10 digits again. That's 347-857-2710, and it's going to be a wonderful show today. And I have a few questions before I introduce our guest. Are you looking for a process to help you discover meaning in your life? Do you want permission to write without censoring yourself? And are you holding back yourself and waiting for inspiration to strike? Well, I hope you don't touch your internet radio dial if you answered yes to any one of those questions, because my guest today, who is founder of Right Wisdom and Providence Press, is the solution to a personal journey of discovery through writing. And I'm very excited about having her here, if I can get the words out. Please welcome Lauren Stevens. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Lauren. How are you?
I'm great. I mean, I love the Lauren thing. It's like talking to myself. I mean, how fabulous is that? Two Laurens in one show.
I know. And it was an unusual name in the days when my parents decided to give me that terrific name. No one else had it, but over time, it's become a popular name.
I think so. Were you named after somebody in particular?
You know, I was named after my uncle. My name was spelled L-O-R-I-N, and I'm L-O-R-E-N, and I think that there's a clue there, because I think my parents really wanted a son, and they were all set with that name, and then I came along, and so they just gave it a little bit of a twist, and here I am.
And here you are.
Yes.
I know. My mother named me, I'm the L-A-U-R-E-N version. And my mother was very much into the films of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and Lauren Bacall, or I guess some people pronounce it Loren Bacall.
Yes.
So I guess she's my namesake. So it's you're right. It's I mean, even today, even though it's more common, it's still not as common as other names.
Well, whenever I hear someone yell out Lauren in a crowded room, I always turn around thinking they're after me, but it turns out that five other Laurens have also turned around.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, it's interesting to see, you know, what color you come in, what hairstyle you come in when you look around. Oh, you're a Lauren? That's so interesting. I never imagined anything like that.
That's right.
Well, this lovely Lauren, which is you, you've had just an illustrious career all over the boards, and I just recently learned that you were once an editor of economic books.
That's right. I worked at Houghton Mifflin Publishing Company in Boston. I don't even know if Houghton Mifflin is a standalone publishing company at this point, but back in the day, it was a very well-known company that published both college and high school textbooks as well as what we call trade books. And I had moved to Boston, newly married, and was looking for a job, and Boston was one of the publishing capitals of the world. So I knocked on the door at Houghton Mifflin, and the only opening that was available at that time was to become an editor of economics textbooks, and I had absolutely no real knowledge of economics, quite frankly, but I guess I was a good enough writer that I managed to pass their test, and they hired me, and I worked there for 2 years editing some very interesting books, Economics and Social Responsibility, How Corporations Can Do Good in the Community, and that was a relatively new topic. I also did a book on personal finance, which is kind of on point today as everyone is scrambling to get their taxes in for April 15th. I'm happy to say that I did it via email, and I'm done with it, and terribly happy about that.
I know, it's kind of a relief. There seems to be a pressure that has been removed from one's shoulder and maybe from one's wallet also.
Well, definitely both in my case.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's, I mean, that, and the previous book that you mentioned about social responsibility for government, that would be a timely book now.
Definitely. Well, it's actually Corporations and Social Responsibilities, How Corporations Can Do More Within Their Communities, which was really a very novel idea at the time. And, you know, today it's sort of part of the one of the arrows in the quiver of public relations for any major company who wants to look like a good corporate citizen.
Right. That's very true. Grassroots, you know, involving the mom and pop so that the end user feels that they're just like us.
Right.
On a certain level. So after your two-year stint editing economic books, how did you find your way to more, I would say, personal writing and memoir?
Well, it was a really long journey, but just to sort of laser beam it, I ended up in the mortgage banking business writing, offering memorandum for our clients, and found that I was very good at selling, and I ended up originating about $100 million worth of loans for mainly hospitals around the country, and I traveled all over the United States doing that for a number of years. I had a very terrific boss who was a wonderful mentor to me, and so I thrived in that business. But eventually I really needed to sort of set my roots down again, and I found my way to California, having divorced my husband, who was in the entertainment business. And he had been producing theater and doing movies, and I just sort of looked over his shoulder and said, this is something I want to do. I ended up as a producer, and I produced some 30-odd plays here in Los Angeles on many different topics, mostly those that had some content of social responsibility. I did The Normal Heart, which was about the AIDS epidemic. I did a play called Hannah Senish about Israel's national heroine. I produced a play called Getting My Act Together and Taking It on the Road. You might remember that one.
Sure.
It was kind of part of the sort of feminist movement. And from that, I segued into producing films. I did a film called Legacy of the Hollywood Blacklist, and then several other sort of fascinating films, one on the life of Sojourner Truth, and I did a bilingual film on Hispanic folk traditions, always looking at the social significance of a particular issue, not just entertainment, but something broader. Mm-hmm. And as I was producing, and my sort of area of expertise was doing the fundraising side of it, so a lot of people were coming to me about their projects, I had a desire to write, and began doing that, working on the scripts, not only being executive producers, but also writing scripts, and that led me into my life's passion, which has always been writing. And I always say to my students that you can never get away from your passion. Eventually, you find your way on that long, winding road to what it is that maybe you dreamt about when you were in the seventh grade as your life's dream. And somehow many of us find ourselves taking rather circuitous routes, mine being economics, textbooks, and mortgage banking. But I eventually found my way back to my real passion, which was writing. And so that's where we are today, really. And I've had the tremendously good fortune to work my way into a full-time career as a writer.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I mean, although, you know, you mentioned a circuitous route and your turn as an editor for economic books, sometimes we feel those things pull us away from our passion, but little do we know that sometimes they add to the prize. It's something we need to do to get where we need to go.
Well, I think, you know, that's absolutely true. And you don't have a crystal ball. You don't always know what the next step is going to be and why you're in the place that you're in. But 20 years, when you look back, you suddenly have the insight that, oh, that's why I did what I did. And that is, you know, part of the memoir writing process is that journey of discovery and the notion of examining your life from the perspective of who you are today and looking back at yourself as that young child and that teenager and, you know, the young mother or career woman, you start to see patterns. I always tell my students, I repeat this over and over again, but I truly believe this, that an unexamined life is not worth living. It's not my saying. I think it comes from a Greek philosopher. If one of your callers is listening in and they know the source of it, I would greatly appreciate it.
Yes, really. We need names.
Getting the
we need
possible.
Names.
I
no
would
Greek.
Love getting the correct attribution. And if I have a minute later, I actually will Google it and see if we can find out where that comes from. But I really believe that examining your life through writing, through the process of writing, is probably the greatest gift that you can give yourself because it is a process of discovery and it is for yourself, but it then can become something you can share with everyone because I believe, A, that everyone has a story to tell. People may not think that they do, but once you have a sort of intelligent and compassionate listener, you discover that you do have a story to tell. And the other part of it is that every story has a universality to it. Every story has a broader message that can perhaps bring some solace or light or insight, understanding to your reader. I remember when I suggested to my mother about writing her book, and that was the first book that I did, she said, you know, what have I got to say? Why would anybody want to read it? Well, I can tell you that, you know, we finished that journey of writing her memoir and published 300 books, and they all flew off her private shelves to people all over the country that she knew and family, and it became, you know, a little mini family bestseller.
That's wonderful. And, you know, I guess I want to clarify something before we go further, because I do want to find out how what kind of steps you take with your clients. But in your terms, what is the difference between an autobiography and a memoir?
You know, I sometimes use those terms interchangeably, life story, memoir, autobiography. But if we're really being strict about it, an autobiography is very much a beginning to end story with exact dates, places, names, everything has to be carefully researched. It's very history-based, whereas a memoir is very impressionistic, and you don't have to tell the whole story. You really want to tell those parts of your story that have what I call the juice, that are the emotional content of your life, and they may not. And when you write it, it may not be in sequential order, but it may jump all over the place just like memory does, because the only way to write memoir is to rely on your memory. That's where the word comes from. I often use as an example of the opposite of a memoir, Catherine Graham's book, her life. She hired somewhere around 200 researchers to work with her to make sure that every page of her autobiography was true to form, which isn't surprising since she was the editor, publisher, and owner of the Washington Post and came out of the world of journalism. And anyone who is a journalist knows that you have to have three reliable sources before you can put something in an article. Well, that is not the case with memoir or life story. You can give yourself the liberty to, you know, be quite selective in what it is that you want to write about.
Well, it's very interesting, and I think it's also timely that in the L.A. Times today, I don't know if you read it, there in the calendar section, there was an article about Kitty Kelly,
uh-huh.
who has just written the
unauthorized.
Thank you. I had a little brain fade. An unauthorized biography of Oprah Winfrey. And
yes.
Now she spoke to, I don't know, maybe in excess of 200 people,
mm-hmm.
and to get insight into Oprah Winfrey and the reviewer of the book said it was pretty good, and that the one thing that Oprah is very good at, according to this article, was not sharing herself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there was a story at one point she was going to do a memoir or autobiography, and then for her own personal reasons, she decided that she didn't want to do it. But I think that we will hear from Oprah at some time in the future when she's gotten to a place in her life where she feels that she's ready to share some of the stories that may be very painful for her, and that also the joyful stories. I always say to my students, you know, a memoir doesn't have to be, you know, I was born, something terrible happened to me, I clawed my way back up, and now I'm a big success. You know, people say, well, why are memoirs always so sad? Well, it's not really true. I could point to many memoirs that are happy memoirs, but very often memoirs are sad because life can be sad. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just the way the cards fall sometimes.
The way life works and how and what choices we have in life.
Exactly.
You know, which way we go. Do we decide to go up the ladder or down the ladder? So.
Right.
It's just very interesting. So how, let's say a client comes to you and wants to write a memoir, what would be, just to give our listeners just some kind of an example of how you begin the process?
Mm-hmm. You know, I work as a ghostwriter. In other words, my name does not even appear on their books. So the first and foremost task that I have is to write in their voice, so that when someone reads the book, they don't feel that there's another person that is interfering in the experience of hearing that voice. And the way I start is really, tell me where you were born. And that just sets them off and running. And we work. Typically, I will do 10 two-hour interviews, and I'm sharing this process because many of your listeners may want to interview their parents, which I think is just an incredibly valuable enterprise. You will find out things about your parents you may never have known before.
I did. I asked my father a question.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, and I realized that there might have been three children instead of two.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of the secrets in the family.
Well, I don't know. I guess you could call it a secret.
Yeah.
I didn't know, but obviously uh-huh. it wasn't meant that. I don't know if it was not meant to be told, but just how it all came about, I thought, wow, so even your comment about talking to people, and I think it – sometimes we speak to people and don't listen, so here's an opportunity to hear a story.
Mm-hmm. So my process is that typically I'll do 10 two-hour interviews. I keep it to 2 hours or less simply because after 2 hours, everybody's eyes glaze over. You know, you can only really focus on listening attentively for, I think, up to 2 hours. At the end of that period, and the questions will be very far-ranging, and often it is just a very open-ended question that will lead my subject to many different ideas. And as we all know, when we're talking and we're sitting down, like you and I've chatted over lunch, we run over a whole range of topics that may not seem that connected, but they have a theme that runs through them. And it's very important when you interview someone that you allow them to go at their own pace and to take you where they want to go. You will gently sort of nudge them back to a main theme that you might have. For example, what was it like at your high school? And, you know, most of us have had pretty interesting experiences in high school, some wonderful, some terrible. And that leads to a lot of rich conversation. At the end of those 10 hours, I usually have their story down pretty well. And I will then write a first draft. And after that, we'll sit together and look over the material and make whatever changes are important, what things have been left out. One of the triggers, and this is something that all of your listeners can use when they're writing their own stories, is to start unearthing letters, photographs, citations, whatever archival materials about their life. You become an anthropologist of your own life story, because those pictures and letters will trigger events in your life that can become inspirations for anecdotes and scenes that you're going to be writing. Who was in that scene with you? You know, was it your sister? Was it your brother? Was it a best friend? Where were you? What was happening to you? How did you feel in that particular moment? And it's just an amazing way to get the mind moving and working and get the memory lubricated, as it were. I also use a couple of tips, and you can use it on yourself when you're interviewing yourself, as it were, as you're writing. Very often someone will say, "I can't remember." And I'll say, "Well, if you did remember," and you'd be amazed how it just opens it up, and they do remember what happened. I don't know why it works that way, but it just does. Another tip is, and this was given to me by a very famous psychoanalyst at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Paul Buttonweiser. He said, just ask the question, "And what happened next?" And then just be quiet. And you can ask yourself that very same question, "What happened next?" Another kind of open-ended question that really unlocks a lot is to ask the question, "How did you feel?" Because ultimately the reader of your memoir or book, that's the thing they most want to know, is your feeling in a particular situation. Otherwise, something just becomes a recitation. When you think about the books that you've really, really loved, they're the books where you get into the heart of the characters and you understand their motivation. What they were feeling at a heart level. And memoir writing is about tapping not only your brain, but also your heart.
Well, it sounds like you have to be a little bit of a psychologist also to somehow, as you mentioned earlier, keep people on a certain path, or someone might come to you and say, "I want to write my memoir about this part of my life," and after the investigation of this person's life, you feel that maybe something else is more interesting, or what they originally wanted to write is just a smaller piece of the pie.
Absolutely, and that comes with time and with sitting with them. And sometimes they will say, "Okay, turn off the recording machine. I want to tell you something." And that's when you really, you know, when the hair starts standing up on my head.
That's when you want the recording machine on.
Because I know something really interesting is about to be said. And then it's up to me, as the attentive listener, to find a way, if I feel that that's something important, to encourage them to include it in their book. I'm not asking someone to divulge someone else's secrets per se, and to, you know, this is not a muckraking adventure, nor is it a pity party. But if it's something that is extremely powerful, that motivated them to choose, you know, road A versus road B, I will encourage them. And sometimes it takes going back to that question a couple of times. I'll give you a specific example, because I think examples are always the best way of sort of illustrating a point. My mother, at the age of 12, was in her bedroom and had left her silk stockings on the floor. Those were the days when women wore silk stockings.
Nice.
And her mother came into the room and went into such a rage that she dragged my mother by the hair into the bathroom and shoved her head against the tile floor and nearly killed her. And it was only through the intercession of my grandfather, who was in his office downstairs, that she stopped. And my mother said, "I don't want to write that about, you know, my mother." And I said, "Well, you know, it's such an important element in your relationship with your mother and kind of makes you a much more sympathetic character." And she said, "Well, let me think about it." And I went back to it. And I said, "And besides which, Grandma is dead, you know, and you really don't have to worry about retribution." She said, "Oh, okay, keep it in."
Wow, you see, the fear of our parents or siblings have over us still.
Mm-hmm.
I find that fascinating.
Yes, well, sometimes, you know, in memoir writing, the truth is really, you know, I always say that you have to be a truthful narrator, which means that your reader has to believe in you, believe you. And it's you know, at this time when we do have a history of memoirs that have been falsified, you know, publishers are becoming more and more wary of the memoir form and don't often fact check and leave it up to the writer. So you as the writer need to try to be as truthful as you can, and by truth I mean it's more the emotional truth of a situation than it is whether you wore a red dress or a green dress or this conversation happened exactly the way you've written it down, you know, just so long as you get the spirit of it. That, to me, is the most important.
I agree. I think because it opens people's vulnerability, and that's what is interesting to people. That's why
exactly.
Their
strength. I always say that people who write their life story become the hero of their own story, because I think most of us are really survivors. And in the end, that's the message that comes across, you know, of how we each survived those hard times in our life. My mother always used to say, you know, after her book was finished, "I haven't had an easy life, but I've had a fascinating one." And I think that's a great feeling, you know. I haven't had an easy life, but I've had a fascinating one.
Have you written your own memoir?
You know, I'm working on a book of my two Japanese mothers-in-law. That's kind of a mouthful, but I'm married to a Japanese man who was born in Japan, and his birth parents gave him up for adoption to his aunt and uncle who were living in America. They're Japanese-American. And so I spent time with my husband's adoptive mother, who currently lives in Vernal, Utah. And then she and I went to Japan, to Osaka, and I interviewed his birth mother, and I met on page 214 of their story.
Wow, I like that title, just my two Japanese mother-in-law.
Yes.
It's a mouthful, but I love it. It has such a visual.
Thank you. Well, it's an incredible opportunity. First of all, going to Japan and spending time with my two mothers-in-law was so amazing. We went to a mountain village called Arashiyama, which is a spa town, and I ended up in a Japanese bathtub naked with my two Japanese mothers-in-law, and the three of us were floating around laughing. And you know, I think that was sort of once in a lifetime. I wasn't going to actually get into the bathtub, and then I said, you know, when in Rome.
Exactly.
You know, I was not going to miss the opportunity. So the book isn't quite a memoir because both women have not memory lapses in terms of dysfunctionality, but some things in their life they have maybe chosen to block out or can't remember for other reasons. My one mother survived Hiroshima and has given me a really vivid description of that, which is something you'd think she would want to block out. But other things like the illness of her husband, many parts of that story are missing. So what I've really done is used a form that I invite your listeners to think about, which is creative nonfiction. It's fictional in that a lot of things are imagined, but it's based on a true story. You know, it's almost some of the films that you see, you know, quote, based on the true story of. And I have found that to be the best form for me to use because it's freed me up to fill in a lot of the blanks. And what's happened to me is that many of the characters in the story have started visiting me when I go to my writing studio. And I recommend to everyone who's listening that you find a place in your house or apartment or wherever that is your sanctuary, where you know when you sit down in that chair that you're there for the business of writing. And I've been lucky enough to have my own little private office out of my house, which is surrounded by Buddhas and beautiful Tibetan rugs and gorgeous silk curtains, and I play Japanese music, and I just get my head into a certain space, which allows me to go back and to call forth all of these voices, many of whom are gone.
Well, that's fascinating. A question just eluded me, but I was going to ask you about. You talk about don't let inspiration come. Don't wait for inspiration.
Right.
It sounds like you create a setting for yourself to be inspired, and once you sit there for that sole purpose of the business of writing, you can't help but be creative to start.
That's right. I mean, if you, you know, so many writers will tell you if you wait for inspiration to hit you, you'll be sitting there till doomsday. You know, you have to just sit down. I have a wonderful writing teacher called Barbara Abercrombie who teaches at UCLA, and she gives two pieces of advice to all of her students. Read everything you can and write.
Oh, that's simple.
And, you know, Annie Lamott is another great, great teacher and writer. She wrote a book that I recommend to everyone called Bird by Bird. The title comes from a conversation she had with her little brother who was given the assignment to write a big, long essay on birds. And he asked Annie, how do I start? What do I do? And she said, you just write it, bird by bird. And I say you just start word by word. You know, just go. And I will give my writing students 5 and 10 minute writing assignments with a simple prompt. And I say just don't pick up the pen, just write. Or, you know, a lot of people now do everything on the computer, although I find, you know, using a pen sometimes is great. When I do my long pieces, I'm always using a computer because my brain is working so fast I can't keep up with it. But in my classes, a lot of people will just arrive, you know, with pad and paper and pen, and that's just fine. And the other thing is that sometimes it's great to be in a workshop because there's a certain energy, electricity, that runs through the room, so you're not by yourself. Because a writer's life, as you know, as you can imagine, can sometimes be very lonely. I mean, you can sit there for an hour, you know, sipping your Starbucks and thinking, okay, you know, here I am all by myself. Who can I call? You know, and you end up calling the weather.
<You know? laughs> maybe they have insight. It's going to rain
really,
in this chapter.
It can get really pretty lonely in there.
Well, Well, you know, but writers can have a very vivid imagination, and that's where the beauty of these characters come from. And like you mentioned in your writing workshops, when you have people who are there for a like-minded reason,
yes,
it can be very helpful and inspirational to help you move forward in your own piece.
And the other thing that I think is so, well, that I find so exciting is that people discover things they never even thought they thought about. I'll give them a writing prompt like, I would like you to give me a memory of rain. And one of my students wrote the most magnificent piece about the day it rained when he was a little boy, and mind you, this guy's probably in his 70s. And his mother was so worried that she got on her bicycle and rode all the way to school to pick him up. And the whole class was crying. It was such a moving thing. You know, here's a mother so dedicated. She doesn't want her little boy, you know, who had gone to school without an umbrella or galoshes or anything else to, you know, and it brought back memories of his mother. And he could take that little prompt and blow it open and write a whole chapter on his relationship with his mother.
That's beautiful. But see, that going back to what we were talking about earlier about my story is not important enough to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Here you're just giving an example of just a prompt to begin a story, and look how
yep.
beautiful that story is.
Right. Oh, and it was. And as I say, there wasn't a dry eye, and it was all... it was all honest feeling. And he, too, was so moved, you know, and he kind of said afterwards, I didn't know I had all that in me. So that's what happens when you write. You just have to be ready for it.
Yeah, I think you probably have to have Kleenex boxes.
A lot of
because you never know if it's going to rain or be sunny.
But the alternative of that, and I really feel this very strongly, is that a lot of times when you've gone through a difficult time, writing about it reorders it for you and gives you an opportunity to look at it in a less, as a feeling of a victim and more in control of what happened. And the insight that comes out of it can be the prize, you know, or the pot at the end of the rainbow, as it were. Yes, I had this terrible thing happen to me, but, you know, I've survived it. I grew in my life. It brought me to a different place. And so what seemed like a terrible tragedy can sometimes, through writing, turn out to be a big win.
I think that's very true. What do you say to those writers who self-edit, meaning they'll write a sentence or a paragraph, and
mm-hmm.
then instead of going with the flow of the writing, no matter how incoherent it is, they'll go back and edit it because it's not, quote-unquote, perfect or what they think it should be?
Mm-hmm. I tell them bluntly, you'll never get finished. You know, you'll never be finished. You have to allow yourself to write what Annie Lamott calls a shitty first draft. The minute you start censoring yourself and listening to the voice in you that says, why are you doing this? You've got nothing to say, or look at your grammar, it isn't very good, you're never going to get up the mountain. You're just going to be stuck down at the first step.
So do you address those voices that you hear in your head, or?
You know, I tell them to be quiet. I mean, for example, with my own book, I'm on page 212. I have not read my first page. I just keep moving forward. Now, when I get to the end, of course, I'll go back and I'll have readers read my work and give me input. But if I tried to go back too far, I'd never get finished. Because what if there's some stuff in there that isn't really very good? It's just going to discourage me, and that's not the point. The point is to get to the end of the story. And then you can polish, you know? There's time for that. The other thing I would say to people is give yourself time. You know, when I started writing this book, I thought I would be done in 6 months and ready to go to print.
How long has it been?
I'm now in year, going on year two. Yeah. of course, I've written many memoirs in between for clients. So this is not my only thing that I do, and I also write personal essays, which are terrifically fun because they're a short form. You know, they're 500 to 2,000 words, and if you're lucky, you get them published and you see your name out there and you can call yourself an author. You know, I'm not somebody who believes that you just write for yourself. I think ultimately you want to be able to share what you have to say with the world. And so I always encourage my students, whether it's to submit something to a local newspaper or to a literary journal, get something called the Writer's Marketplace, subscribe to writers' magazines like The Sun magazine, which is just a fantastic magazine, and in it has a section called Readers Write, and it gives you writing prompts, and you can send in pieces and see your work out there in 3 or 4 months. And they're looking for pieces that show deep emotional content. They're not so much looking for, quote, you know, the next Ernest Hemingway. So I'm shameless when it comes to the idea of seeing my work in print. I really push to do that.
That's wonderful. And you know, on another show we were talking about, I had a psychologist on and we were talking about a mentor, and she had a mentor that really turned her life around as far as her career path. And here you're telling me that you knew that you loved writing as a young child. Was there someone that mentored you in your writing career?
Not really. I think, you know, my studying with writers at UCLA, for example, has been fabulous. In fact, I'm going to a writer's retreat in 2 weeks, and I have a writer's group myself of 4 other writers, and we get together once a month and read each other's work. But insofar as, you know, a sort of typical story of, you know, a high school teacher who said, oh, Lauren, you know, you write so well, I think you should be a writer. No, I didn't have anyone like that. In fact, my own parents dissuaded me from going to graduate school in English literature, which is what I wanted to do. My father said to me, what are you ever going to do with a master's in English lit? You know, why don't you go be a lawyer? So instead, I went to graduate school in international affairs at Columbia. But
and what are you doing with that now, Lauren?
Nothing. You know, but it's part of the mix, right?
Of course.
I mean, it is. It's part of the mix. Maybe I wouldn't have had such a good time in Japan if I didn't have some knowledge of, you know, the history of World War II and Japanese-American relations.
Exactly. So now your workshops, we're almost running out of time, so I want to get all this kind of in.
Okay.
Your workshops are for new writers, beginning writers, people who have been writing?
All of the above.
All of the above. And when's the next one?
Yes. I'm going to be doing one. Actually, it's not open to the public, but it's up at the Oaks at Ojai. I don't know if you've heard of that. They're having me come up to be the guest speaker for one of the evenings. Probably the next public one will be sometime in the fall, probably at the Bowers Museum down in Santa Ana, where I do a lot of my teaching. But you can go on my website, which I constantly update, and I may have one, you know, sometime this summer. I will also be in Santa Fe, where I'm going to be doing a workshop, probably at the International Folk Art Museum. But my website is Write Wisdom, WriteWisdom.com, and there is a section that says workshops, lectures, and personal appearances, and you can
see.
You know,
and people can contact you and
yes, they can contact me through my website if they're interested in talking about a writing project that they have. I'm happy to talk to them. I coach writers. You know, who have projects underway and they just need some, you know, some gentle nudging or input. And then, of course, I do the full-blown memoir, which is kind of the start to finish.
Beautiful. Well, thank you. I don't know where the 45 minutes went, but it was so delightful, and I'm wanting to learn more myself. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And, again, you can reach Lauren at writewisdom.com. And please join me next for another wild and crazy journey in someone else's shoes. This is Lauren Leibowitz, and thank you for joining me on How to Be Comfortable in Your Own Shoes. We see you next time and look forward to helping you find comfort. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lauren. It was wonderful.
It was great. Thank
you
so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.